You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Hello, and welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and I'm recording an abbreviated introduction, really because I'm limited by a 55-minute cutoff by some of the places this is posted, and I don't want to cut out almost anything from my conversation with Carol Bell, who is a therapist and the mother of former country western singers Luke Bell. And in response to that, in response to Luke's death, Carol created the Luke Bell Memorial Affordable Counseling Program, and it's worth talking about, and I hope you will tune in and listen. I so enjoyed my conversation with Carol. I hope you do as well. All right, here we go. Hello, everybody. It's David Bryan, and as promised, Curiosity Invited, and as promised, I am speaking with Carol Bell, a name that, well, you know, if you're a local, you might know her name. Local, everybody's local, but local to Wyoming, northwestern Wyoming. Carol Bell, as I said, is a therapist, but she was not always a therapist. She was a business owner. She was a teacher. She originally studied English and American literature, et cetera, et cetera. So Carol, thank you for being here. And we're going to talk about a bunch of different things, I think. And I really appreciate you giving your time. So thanks.
I'm happy to be here.
Good. Good. You rushed from a therapy appointment to here, so which meant what? You sort of turned around in your chair.
Yeah, exactly.
I love the short commute of working at home.
Yeah, it's great.
So yeah. Well, so let's start with was there anything to say about the fact that you were born in Shell and grew up on a ranch? And I think the rest of the world. Very romantic about that, right? You know, it's like, oh, you grew up on a ranch. And should they be?
Should they be? Wow, that's a hard question. I guess that I will say as a child, it was romantic. I mean, I was also taught to be very tied into the romantic notion of ranching. And we were taught to be very proud. If we whined when we were moving cattle, which we did from a very early age, and often our days started, we would get up at like 3:30 in the morning to be out in the desert before it got hot so we could get the cattle moving. And we wouldn't get home until 7 or so at night. And if we were 8 or 10 years old, that's a pretty long day.
You bet.
And sometimes with very little food and water. And if we whined, my parents would say, most kids would give their eye teeth to be out here.
They're right.
So we're taught to buy into the romantic notion. But as I've gotten older, I guess I realize that the life I was taught to believe I was leading was not the life I was leading.
Oh, that's interesting. That's mysterious. What does that mean?
It's just a very patriarchal culture still. And
it's a men's world.
It's a man's world. And it's sort of based on this idea that of the strong, independent type, it will persevere. And actually, ranchers depend heavily on one another, on their neighbors and community members, and also they do depend on public grazing space and because they, and I, you know, it's important, they do, they are raising our food, but they also do get a lot of government support when there are forest fires or, you know, so I feel like, yeah, it's definitely kind of a, you only see the romantic part.
Yeah. It's so interesting that, I mean, because on the one hand, geez, this was not what I was going to talk about, but here we go. See, I think so many people, I think there is something really special about growing up in, well, first of all, raising food, whatever it comes to. I mean, it's, you know, if it used to be that everybody was a farmer, right? Everybody was a farmer or a rancher, right? And now, what is it, 1%, less than 1% of the population, and they make the food for everybody else. They make life possible. That's incredible and important. And it, there is a certain thing that, that growing up in the city, you don't, you know, most people don't even get their fingernails dirty.
And so I guess I will say that that is one of the beautiful things about my childhood is I think it, when I think about my own resilience, my own mental health, I think it is really such a gift to be raised with so much meaning and purpose. Mm-hmm. To, you know, we did feel like the work that we were doing was really important. It mattered. It mattered because we were raising food, but it also, if we didn't show up for work, sometimes things died. So it did feel like the work that we did, even as children, doing chores was important. And also the ranch that my family owns has been in the family since 1901. And so I was the fourth generation. And there is definitely this sense that there is an intellectual property, a knowing of the landscape, a knowing of the seasons and the and the kind of interdependence between the ranch I grew up on and nature that you could not acquire in one lifetime. Mm. And so there is this idea that you are inheriting a knowledge that took many generations to acquire, and that it is a very important gift that you're not really worthy of. And so I, you know, in a spiritual sense, I think growing up on a ranch, it was just easy to remember how small you were, while at the same time feeling like you were important and your life had meaning.
Yeah, that, you know, since moving here, I grew up, you know, I grew up in suburbs and cities, and sort of gradually moved to more treed rural places. And now, although I live in town, it's Powell and it's a ranch farm community. So you know, one of my friends, I don't know, maybe you know him, maybe you don't, he's an organic farmer, he's a farmer, Rod Morrison, who's a wonderful guy. And it is absolutely true that there is a knowledge that, you know, I look up at the sky and it's beautiful. He looks up at the sky and it's beautiful and it means something. And you just know that it's true. And it's interesting. Years ago, I met a woman. And she was embarrassed that, you know, her parents were farmers. I was like, what are you talking about? Like, they grow food. Like, we need it. No one survives without that. So anyway, I It just, I wasn't even, that wasn't even on my mind, but thank you for that. You started to speak about it's a weird culture, weird. It's not a word to use these days, I suppose. It's taken on a whole different meaning, but there is an unusual culture, and it's probably true everywhere, but it feels more pronounced here, meaning, you know, this climate, cowboy country, and there is a sense of, as you spoke about it, there's a sense of, you know, we are independent, we are, you know, I do it on my own, and nobody does anything on their own. I mean, they get in a tractor that some, if there was not a factory, you're not on that tractor, so, but I also know that, and because we've spoken about this, but I also know that, you know, that seeps, it's cherry picked, right? We're independent. So there are certain things you don't ask for help for, even though we get this invisible help all the time. And it takes its toll. And you know that in an unfortunate and a personal way, that, you know, there is everybody, maybe not young people. I suspect you also have clients that, you know, have been suffering in distress because they're supposed to. They're not supposed to have those kinds of issues. And if they do have that problem, you know, they're supposed to get over it, suck it up, cowboy up.
Right. And I guess I would say that, you know, the cowboy culture, the romantic culture of cowboying just takes a very American notion to the extreme.
Yeah.
So, you know, the idea of survival of the fittest and that's not a cowboy, that's an American notion. And I feel like cowboys are sort of the icon for that American ideal that we hold high. And so maybe sometimes those of us who are a part of that culture feel like we especially have to take that notion to the extreme. But I definitely feel like I don't have any clients. I'm thinking right now, I think all my clients are American. And so I don't really think I have any clients right now who don't struggle with their shame about needing help. And often their mental health crisis or whatever, you know, the struggle that led them to come to see me comes from their struggle to give themselves permission to have a bad day or a bad week or a bad, you know, 6 months, which, you know, which is why we often end up in therapy after a big loss or a trauma, because suddenly we're not doing so well if we don't give ourselves permission to be sad.
It's a paradox, because on the one hand, being able to be resilient and being able to be independent and do things when nobody else is around and you're capable and all of that is good. But making that the ethos, you know, has all of like that's the way you ought to be. And across the board, first of all, nobody ever is, right? I mean, we're supported. I was listening to somebody talk about, you know, a theory of physics that makes it clear, you know, nothing exists independently, right? Everything relies on so many other things, and so there's a way in which it's never true, and yet there is something about it that is true, right? That some people rise to the occasion in ways that are good and important. And then there's the dark side of that people don't know when to ask for help, when it's okay to ask for help and help of the sort that, you know, that you now provide. And I know it's relatively recent, right? You're a therapist. Well, you're now a therapist as of this past summer.
Right. Well,
and what is the title, by the way? Are you a psychologist? Or are you a therapist?
So I have a master of counseling. I know some people have, like, I have a niece who's a psychologist and that's a PhD.
Yeah.
And I think the master of counseling is newer. And also, since I didn't go back to school until I was in my late 50s, I definitely was feeling like I don't have time to get a PhD because I want to get to work. So I was looking for a more.
Sure. Sure.
Quicker path.
Yeah. You were drawn to become a counselor, but not because of, and we should say, you know, we'll be speaking about the Luke Bell Memorial Foundation. I think that's the correct name, the full name. And you know, sadly, that's a memorial because your son, Luke Bell, died. And partially, or, well, who knows how, but whether those things are partial or otherwise. In something you wrote, you said he died from mental illness. And I mean, you don't have to go into detail, but you certainly can. But that wasn't what drew you to become a counselor.
Right. So I think I told you in our previous conversation that I have a master's degree in American Lit.
Yes.
I studied under Wendell Berry, and I kind of focused on agrarian topics in literature. And I think.
I just have to say, you know, I mean, and maybe nobody who's listening to this will know that name, but those of us who do know that name for, like, you know, I studied with Wendell Berry is like, what?
Yeah, it's just as great as it sounds. It was just as great as it sounds. And I it's not that big of a leap from my love of reading has to do with my interest in what makes people tick. I do think that oftentimes when we read, we are looking for people that make us feel less lonely. You know, we are looking for characters that are experiencing something that we recognize. And the literature that we are drawn to often has something to do with a human experience that resonates with us. So I majored in English because I took a class that Wendell Berry was teaching, and I got really excited about agrarian topics in literature, and I decided, well, I might as well get my master's degree and just keep taking these classes until I run out.
Until they throw you out.
And also because I just, you know, in the 80s when I was going to college, you know, and I was in Kentucky at that time, but I grew up in Shell, Wyoming. I never heard of therapists. So I'm sure there were some on a sitcom I watched, but also we only had one channel of television and it wasn't a very good one. So I feel like my ideas about what I could be when I grew up were kind of narrow. I thought I could be a rancher's wife, a teacher, and like a secretary. And, you know, I knew a woman who was a lawyer, but I wasn't very, I don't really like conflict. So that wasn't something that ever was attractive to me. And I knew women who were nurses, but I didn't really like science. So I think that in my I went to a therapist in my early 40s, and I think the minute I went to a therapist, I thought it would be interesting to be a therapist.
Did you go here somewhere in Wyoming?
Or I did. I went to a woman who is now retired, and it was a great experience for me. I went when my stepdaughter was getting married, and she was marrying in Shell, my hometown, and probably feeling a little worried about what it was going to feel like for her mom to be in my hometown for her wedding. And so we were having a hard time planning the wedding together. And I really wanted to be a good stepmom, and I was kind of angry at her and frustrated. And so I went to therapy to get some help with that. Oh. And it was a really great experience for me. And I was a person who had never been very interested in herself and didn't really know myself very well. And so I learned a lot. And I guess I felt like that's super interesting to get to know yourself in that way, and then to take what you know about yourself out into the world and look around and how differently things look. It was really empowering for me and exciting. And I think there was just a little seed that was planted in my mind at that time. But I also had two small children, two medium-sized children. And I owned a gift and bookshop, and I was married, and there's no counseling school anywhere near here. And, you know, that wasn't in the 90s. It's probably the late 90s, early 2000. Wasn't a time when I feel like things feel so much easier online since COVID happened. But at that time, we felt like getting an education online, it was inferior. It was an inferior education. But it was something in the back of my mind that I always thought I might do someday when my kids were grown and gone. That was such a long answer that I forgot what the question was.
Me too, but that's okay. I like that part. You're a very thoughtful human being. I like that. Well, let's shift. It's not a sure it's a shift, but because I think it's important to talk about. There's so many overlaps. I don't know if the gift store has an overlap with all of those things, but there are so many things that weave together. You can't use that word either. You can't say weird, and you can't say weave. And my God, what a world! What a world we've created, right? We haven't, but we have. So your son, Luke, Luke Bell, some people may know that, may know his name, and in his story, he died. And what does that mean? He died from mental illness.
I'll tell you what it means to me.
Good.
Because my son actually died of a fentanyl overdose, and when he died. It might have been CBS, some national news program called because they were doing a program on fentanyl, and they wanted me to come because Luke, as it turns out, Luke was well known. We didn't really realize that at the time, how well known he was, but they asked me to come on and talk about Luke and the tragedy of losing Luke to fentanyl. And I said, no, if you don't mind if I talk about mental illness and what a lonely journey it is to be mentally ill in our country, I'll come on. But I don't really feel, yes, Luke died of a fentanyl overdose, but in my mind, he died because he was mentally ill and because the help that he needed is not available in our country. Severe mental illness.
Did he know he was taking fentanyl, or do you think he was taking something else, sort of self-medicating? And you know, this may be an uncomfortable question, in which case just
I guess
tell me
no,
to stop myself.
How would I know? My belief is that he knew what he was taking. My belief is that he may, when I saw him, he'd been in Cody the week before he died, and I did say to his sister, his big sister, my stepdaughter, who was here at the time, when he left, it felt like he was saying goodbye. Because he was very, he told me how much he loved me, and it was a very emotional, heartfelt goodbye. And during his mental illness, Luke was mostly very aloof. And so it was really unusual for him to talk to me openly about how grateful he was for my support and how much he loved me. Mm. So it felt like when they called to tell me they'd found him, I was not surprised, and I felt certain at the time that he had committed suicide. And of course, I will never know if he knew what he was doing, but I do know that he was in a place in his life where he knew that his drug and alcohol behaviors were really dangerous to him. He almost always, after drinking or using drugs, he almost always had a psychotic episode. And those psychotic episodes were really dangerous. He made really bad decisions when he was psychotic. And so I feel like whether or not he was intending to kill himself, he was aware that that was a possibility, and he did not care.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that.
And also, you know, I don't know why. I think it's easier for me to think that Luke, having tried everything, I mean, he tried electric shock treatment, he tried a lot of different kinds of medications, somehow for me to think that it was a choice he made feels less sad for him. Like he had thought about what he wanted for himself, and he didn't feel like he wanted to live the kind of life he would have to live. And so, yeah, I don't know, but to think that it was an accident and that he was still full of hope, that would make me feel sadder.
Sure.
And so I...
Yeah. Right. Obviously be more tragic, right? You know, right. Well, I don't know if it'd be more tragic, but it's because it seems whenever a parent has to bury a child, it's always tragic.
One of the things, and stop me if you don't want me to answer this question that I think you asked me a while back, I haven't gotten to yet, that you're making me think of is when Luke, I was working at Northwest College when I became aware that he was spiraling into mental illness. And I worked with some really nice people, and I love the college. And I was doing work that I don't think I'm particularly cut out to do. I was raising money for the college and then managing the Cody, the satellite school in Cody for Northwest College. And I think I was doing an above average job, but I'm definitely a relationship person, and some office duties are difficult for me. And when Luke started to spiral, and I had lost my husband a few years earlier, and my life was just feeling I was feeling pretty hopeless and sad, and just sort of looking ahead and feeling like, how am I going to keep my head above water? And I think my decision to go to school came out of this place of feeling like, okay, I live alone. I have a lonely life. I'm really scared for my son. It's getting kind of hard to get up in the morning, and I feel like making this dream that I've had for about 20 years of becoming a therapist, making this dream come true would make me feel like my life has meaning and purpose, and I'm doing something that I'm excited about. And I think that I just decided I needed to take that risk so that kind of looking into my future and thinking, if my son isn't going to be a part of my life, at that time he wasn't speaking to me and had been missing for about 3 months, and my husband is dead, this life just feels so much smaller and so diminished compared to the life that I imagined I would have right now.
Yeah.
This is something I think I would be really exciting to me. Yeah. And so I just decided to go for it.
Did you seek, there are two different decisions, obviously, because one is about building a life that, and in some ways, it's a very practical decision, right? Like, my life feels smaller and emptier. And so putting myself into this situation where I'm thinking about things and I'm drawn to those things anyway, and there are other people and, to collaborate with and all. So that's a very instrumental, practical, good. And there was also that, like, did you seek out therapy at that time? Like, were you?
Yeah, I started going to therapy maybe 3 or 4 months after my husband died.
And was that as successful as it was?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It was a very different experience because I think, when I went to therapy, when my stepdaughter was getting married, I felt like, I have a clear problem that I need help solving.
Correct. Right. Yeah.
And when I went to therapy after my husband died, I was feeling like I have all of these emotions. I don't know what to do with them. And I think my friends are getting a little bit tired it's just too much. I need to dump this somewhere every week because I'm offloading it on people who say hello to me in the grocery store. Or,
right.
I just felt a little bit like it was more in the beginning anyway. I feel like I just needed a place to dump.
It's interesting because you might feel like, I'm burdening people I don't want to burden. On the other hand, there is that also that, go back to that original piece of the conversation. There is, I'm not supposed to. I'm supposed to take care of the shit myself. And so.
But I do think that our culture, we are so unrealistic about grief. So, and so was I before I experienced.
Yeah.
Loss of someone, I lost my grandparents, but they died of old age.
Very different.
I feel like, after 3 months, most of my friends were like, you get 2 weeks off from work, right? Most of my friends were like, okay, come on, get a grip, Carol. It's 3 months.
Yeah. Come on, get over it.
Right.
Life goes on.
And not that they would, my friends are great.
Of course.
Not that they would say that. But I do think people start to get tired, and also, and I think this was true of my family members too, they kind of want the old Carol back. She was way more fun than this Carol and way less serious.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
not as sad. And so I wanted the old Carol back too. And I went to therapy because I thought I would get her back.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and what you ended up with was the new and improved Carol.
Right. I don't know improved, but definitely new.
Yeah. You're modest. You're being modest. Well, but then you did this thing And now let's shift to that. So we can spend a little time on the foundation, because I think it's a really important thing to get out there, right? So Luke was, he may not have been a superstar, you know, having won every award, you know, but he was on his way. And you know, for those who pay attention in the country Western world, he was in that world, and folks knew him. And so I'm assuming so royalties started to come in, and you decided to start the Luke Bell Memorial Foundation specifically, and you know it's dedicated to, and let you speak about it, but to open the doors of therapy, of the possibility of mental health help to people who might not otherwise be able to afford themselves of that, right?
So it's actually called the Luke Bell Memorial Affordable Counseling Program.
Ah.
And so it's no wonder you don't remember that, because it's long. Affordable. But we wanted it to say what it is. And I interned in Denver at school in a program very similar to this. And so it's modeled after a program that I participated in as an intern therapist during graduate school.
Yeah.
And the idea, and you're right, Luke does get royalties. And because they hadn't been able to find him regularly the last year or so of his life, the first year there were a lot of royalties. So, and somehow it just didn't feel good to spend the money on fun.
Yeah.
And so my daughters and I decided that, so this is how it works. You know, one of the things that gets in the way, there are a few things that get in the way of therapy, and obviously one of them is cost. But another is just like, you know, you have to have the wherewithal to call a therapist and to fill out the paperwork and answer the questions. And then if that therapist you call is busy, you know, if you spend all this time researching and you decide, I want to see Dr. Shelley Graham, and then you call her and she says, I'm sorry, I don't have any openings. And, so not only do we provide when you apply, all you have to do is say, this is my name, this is where I live, my income is $65,000 a year or less, and I can afford to pay, and you choose some number between $25 and $65 per session. And then, and you can say, so-and-so has already agreed to see me, or I'm working with Carol Bell. Or you can say, I really struggle with anxiety and I live in Powell and I need somebody who works with people with anxiety in Powell. I'd like to see my therapist in person. And if possible, I'd like to see a man. So then we have a committee of two right now who reviews the applications. It's kind of a no-brainer. Almost everyone who applies receives support. The only two people who we've turned away, one of them had insurance. So we don't, unless you haven't met your deductible, we don't award money to people who have already met their deductible. And the other person had already received a scholarship for 10 sessions. And so at the time we were only allowing people to apply once per year, but since then we have voted to allow people to apply twice. Anyway, you fill out the application, the committee approves the application, they reach out and let you know that they've approved the application and that you will hear from a therapist within the next couple of days. And then they either contact the therapist that you've requested, or they find you a therapist.
Oh, wow.
And then so all the work, all you do is fill out the application, and then all the work that can be kind of overwhelming if you're in crisis,
yeah,
is taken care of for you. And when you hear from somebody next, it is your therapist calling to set up an appointment.
And are you sort of, whoever is doing it, are people sort of, you know, beating the door down, right? I mean,
it's been a really lovely pace, because in the beginning, you know, I told the woman that I work for in my agency, and I have friends who are therapists, so I just sort of told therapists about it, and friends who work in the healthcare business. And in the beginning, most people came to us because their therapist told them about it. And they had either, it's the new year and they hadn't met their deductible, or they would never meet their deductible because it was $5,000.
Right.
Or, you know, something. Right. They got divorced and they hadn't found a job yet. So most people early on came to us from their therapist. And so it was kind of a slow build. I think that we launched the program in February, and we probably
February of this year, mm-hmm, of 2024. Oh, so this is really relatively new.
And Luke died in 2022. So we had the idea, right away. And so we put the money in an account, but it took, and we got a domestic nonprofit. It took a while, and we were trying to figure out how to advertise and how to create a website. And then at Christmas, we got a $50,000 donation, and we decided, okay, let's.
A donation independent of the, this is not the royalty. Yeah. This is somebody or some foundation or whatever. Oh, that's wonderful.
And so we used that. That made us feel like, okay, somebody has this kind of confidence in us. Mm-hmm. Let's pay somebody to set up a web page, to design a logo. Let's do it.
Yeah.
So we did. We got a domestic nonprofit. We got everything going. And we probably had about 15 clients by June or July that we were serving. And then now we're at like 35 clients.
Oh, wow.
And we're getting, I think we got 3 or 4 new applicants this week. So we are excited about that, because we're not spending as much money as we hope to be spending. Luke's royalties right now, and I'm sure as time goes by, they'll rise and fall. We still have an album to release, so that'll probably kick things up a little bit, but they're about $20,000 a year, 25, and we would like to for sure be spending $20,000 a year, and we haven't spent that much. We probably will. Two things are surprising. One is that people aren't breaking down the door. It's been a really nice pace. And the other thing is that people really do try to pay what they can afford to pay. And so we just kind of assumed that everyone would want to pay $25 per session. But a lot of people are paying $55 or $65.
Yeah.
And then we pay up to $125. We will pay up to $100 per session. And the therapist can only receive a total of $125.
I see. Uh-huh. And well, that's interesting. So you just made mention of it. You're not seeing this as a kind of sunset organization, right? You know, when the royalties, right? You know, people who stop making music, eventually it peters out. You're at least either actively trying to raise money or contemplating actively trying to raise money.
You know, so far we haven't actively tried to raise money, because every time somebody, or often when people hear about, I got a check for $1,000 today, which, you know, that easily supports 10 sessions,
yeah,
and could support as many as 20, depending on what the client agreed to pay.
Right.
So we haven't had to actively try to raise money yet, because people hear about the program and they support it. And I also, in my mind, imagine that some people will participate in the program. This is my hope, that some people will participate in the program in their 20s and 30s and then go on to have successful lives and feel like they want to support someone like they were when they were in their 20s and 30s and give back. So my hope is that over time, the program does such great work that it creates its own support system.
You're very optimistic, and you might be, and you know, you might be right. And yeah, it's.
And also, I'm not afraid to fundraise. I mean,
yeah, clearly,
we need
right.
to.
Sure, sure, and it and it's, well, well. Here's that. You know, it's circled back to the initial conversation. It's like, you know, there's the puzzle, right? You're not afraid to fundraise, and it's. I was about to say, and it's a. Cause it's a use of funds that in all sorts of ways is very modest and very important and serves the people who need to be served most. And we live in a culture where, although maybe that's shifting, we live in this little corner of the world where going to therapy is something, well, maybe it's everywhere, right? Is it, I mean, when I lived in Los Angeles, people wore the fact that they went to therapy as a badge of honor, right?
And I think that there are more people do that, younger people do that than they did. And I guess I'll just say, you know, one of the things, especially when we started out, you just become aware of the needs that you're not, you know, the needs that are not being filled by the program. Our program is designed, and we have a board of three, and then we have these two committee members, and I have a very involved, interested family, big extended family on my side of the family and David's side of the family. And so we talked about it a lot to sort of think about who it is we want to serve. And one thing we were clear about is we want to serve people who are not being served and people who are motivated. So that is why therapists are not allowed to write off the client's portion. You know, like they cannot say to their client, oh, you don't have to pay your copay. We'll just eat that.
Right.
Because right. we are serving clients who we want them to have some skin in the game. Our belief is that, you know, $25 is like four cups of coffee. And even Luke, when he was homeless, could come up with the money to buy coffee.
Yeah.
So we feel like you should be prioritizing therapy enough to
give up your cup of coffee
a little bit.
Right.
And so we want motivated clients who are motivated and who can afford to pay a little bit. And so there are people that, you know, maybe they get behind on their payments and they're wanting us to help with debt, counseling debt, and we don't do that.
Right.
There are people who can't afford to pay. We don't take those clients.
Yeah.
We don't take people under the age of 18 because our hope is that they're on Medicare or Medicaid.
I see that as wise. I don't know if we spoke about this. I started a school and ran it for about 20 years. And it was a private school, but it was quite specifically an effort to open the doors of private school. I mean, you know, I'm a public school kid. I didn't even know what they were for, private schools. And so this was a real effort to do that. So, and the structure of it was everybody pays something. And some people pay everything, right? Some people pay that much and other people pay that much, but you don't get to get behind. Like, you know, if you get behind, somebody's calling you up. It's like, we need your $10 this month. And because skin in the game matters, right? I mean, like you are making an effort. It's a stretch of some sort. And I think that that's, That's a good idea. Yeah. And it's hard, right? I mean, there's the whole privacy issues. I was going to say, you get feedback that things are going well, but you can't really get feedback because you can't really talk to the therapist,
right,
or whatever.
I think, you know, we're planning to get together with all the therapists who are participating in December and ask for feedback.
Oh, yes. I heard about that because of my wife.
Right. Yeah. And then we'll see if people feel, I mean, you can give feedback about the program, and right, some people have emailed feedback. I think that we can send out, the committee can send an email to the clients asking them if they would like to share feedback. And of course they can say no.
I was going to say anonymous. And plus it could be anonymous. I mean, they could still say lovely things that.
Right. Anonymous. And we would like to be able to tell some of our larger donors.
Yeah.
We would like to be able to share anonymously some feedback.
You bet.
Just so they know that.
Yeah. Your dollars went to a really good thing.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think that's wonderful. I mean, I really do. I think it's wonderful. And and it's a need. It's so clearly a need. I mean, what's interesting in the 4 years that I've been here, so I'm a real newcomer. There's more and more conversation, quite specifically. I mean, you know, in whether the bills pass or not, even the legislature of Wyoming is talking about, you know, improving mental health and mental health support for people who need that. And so it's, you know, one hopes that it's a wave that will keep coming, that not because everybody should be in therapy, although I don't know, maybe you think everybody could get something from it, but which they probably could, but to have that available to people when they can use that support, when they need, for, because, you know, like if we lived in communities that were really communities, maybe nobody would need it, but you said it before, it's like, you know, sometimes you need some help sorting through the mess of life.
Right.
That is sometimes messy.
Right.
And everybody knows it. So whether they want to be tough about it or not, everybody knows it.
Right. So. And, you know, sometimes we're lucky and we have just the right friend or family.
That's right. That's right.
In our lives when we're having a certain kind of crisis. But sometimes, you know, I think in particular about becoming a widow at age 51, I have a lot of friends who are widows, but I didn't have any friends my age who had lost a husband.
Yeah.
And no one in my family knew quite what to do about it. Right. Or, you know, how many layers there are to that kind of a loss. And so.
Plus sometimes families.
Right.
You know, there's so many different entanglements and.
Right.
You know, like you need somebody who.
Friends. Our friends and family, they have an agenda when they listen to us. They want us to get better. And therapists don't necessarily see grief as a neurosis.
Right.
They don't necessarily see a year of sadness as a sign that there is something wrong with you.
Right.
Whereas our friends and family members feel like, honey, you got to get over this. This has been going on way too long.
Yeah. I mean, therapists want to open the windows, pull the curtains back, bring in the light, bring in fresh air, and help you sort of, you know, help you freshen up the rooms.
Right.
Right. And make it livable again. So, well, I'm looking at the time and I promised you time and I promised you not to do much, to do too much time. I have so enjoyed this conversation.
Thanks.
And so thank you. And if there's anything I can do to help, let me know. And, And who knows, maybe we'll speak again. I hope to meet you sometime. You're just down the road.
I know.
After all. So what a pleasure.
Pleasure for me too, David. Thanks.
So thank you. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.